Welcome to Now Appalachia, hosted by author and Appalachian resident Elliot Parker. This show profiles the authors and publishers that have connections to the Appalachian region and how those connections influence and impact their works. And now, Appalachia.
And hello, friends. We welcome you to another episode of Now Appalachia, heard here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm your host, Elliot Parker, and it's great to have you with us today as we continue profiling the outstanding writers and writing that is coming from and connected to the Appalachian region. And on our program today, we're going to be talking about history, more specifically, the revolutionary period of our nation's history, with an outstanding author who has a fantastic new book out that you really need to check out. If you have someone in your family that is a history buff, or you're a history buff, or wants to learn more about the nation's founding and how our early politicians put our country together, this is the book you need to check out. And our guest today is author Lindsay Shervinsky. Her new book is called The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. And Lindsay joins us today as a historian. She is interested in the presidency and early America. She writes about politics, the military, and culture from the 1770s until the 1820s. And she currently works as the White House historian for the White House Historical Association. She previously completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, and also got her PhD at the University of California, Davis. She also holds a bachelor's degree from George Washington University. And she also has plenty of time to do other things outside of writing and reading and working on history. She likes to hike. She has an American foxhound who has the coolest name ever, John Quincy Dog Adams, who she's nicknamed Quincy for short. And those of you who've listened to the program before know that I'm a huge fan of the Adams family from early American history. And so it's so cool to find somebody who's actually named their dog after one of the Adams clan. So with that being said, we want to welcome Lindsay Shervinsky into our program today. So Lindsay, welcome to Now Appalachia. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that fantastic introduction. I love when Quincy, you know, as part of my introduction. It's such a great way to show that historians don't have to be boring.
Absolutely, that is so very true, and I love the name of your dog. I just think that's one of the coolest names ever. And some folks may be listening to our program, and they might be thinking, well, what does this book have to do with Appalachia? And I think one of the things I always like to profile on the program is history and nonfiction and history about the Appalachian region. But what we tend to forget is a lot of what we now know as the Appalachian region was connected to the founding of the 13 colonies. When we think about Virginia, we think about West Virginia, we think about Ohio, we think about the Carolinas, we think about Georgia, we think about some of those states that fall into the Appalachian region. A lot of that territory was part of the original 13 colonies, even if it wasn't designated by states at that particular period. So I'm really excited to have you on to talk to us about your new book, The Cabinet. And so before we get into this, can you just define for our audience who may not be familiar with the term or maybe have forgotten what that is, when we hear that term, a cabinet or the cabinet, or we come across that phrase in your book, what is it exactly that you're talking about with that term?
Absolutely. So today, when we think about the cabinet, we think about the group of anywhere from 15 to 20 individuals that hold positions of high positions of power in the executive branch, department secretaries, chiefs of staff, National Security Council, and they gather every so often to advise the president. Usually the meetings are fairly public. But that really wasn't always the case. The original cabinet was only four guys, and it was a much more private advisory body. And so, in fact, the word cabinet actually comes from Great Britain. And Great Britain, of course, originally had the Privy Council. And then a small little group would break off to the side and consult confidentially with the king. And that was really known as the Cabinet Council. And so the word cabinet actually initially was designed to represent a more private, kind of secretive group that provided advice and support.
Very good. And I think one of the things that we learn about your book is that, you know, we think about presidential cabinets today, and we hear that term if we watch the news. Anytime someone's covering politics or the White House, they talk about the cabinets, and maybe we think about our presidents having those today, and maybe to some degree we think about them, and we think about that, you know, it's something that's kind of taken for granted to some degree. But when Washington was first elected president, we learned this in your book, he didn't really have any precedent to fall back on in terms of a cabinet or in terms of how to put that together or who to trust or who to ask for advice. And he didn't really have any guidelines for how to govern this new nation. You talk a little bit about these war councils that he used when he was a general during the Revolutionary War, which was really interesting. How did those experiences with kind of organizing and collecting these war councils during the Revolutionary War, how did that influence him or help him when he started to create what we now know as the pretty stereotypical or atypical presidential cabinet?
Absolutely. So I think it's really important to emphasize, as you mentioned, how little was actually written down for Washington to follow. I really encourage everyone to look at Article 2 of the Constitution and to see how short it is and how few details are actually prescribed about how the president is supposed to do things day to day. So every single action that Washington was taking was incredibly stressful. It was incredibly rich in detail, and he was thinking about the precedent that he was establishing for the people that were coming after him. And so if we look at Article 2, there isn't the word cabinet there. And so he really actually initially tried to explore some other options before concluding that they were insufficient. And so once he did decide he needed a cabinet, he then turned, as you mentioned, to the councils of war experience that he had had from the Revolution, because that was the sort of military leadership that he knew. That was the experiences that he had had. It had worked very well for him to manage the very unruly personalities of his officers. There were some really big characters in there. Charles Lee would often bring his pack of hounds into the council meetings, and they were loud and boisterous. And so he was not dealing with wallflowers. And they were very opinionated. They were probably, had some pretty big egos. They were used to being listened to. And so he was managing these people through a series of strategies, including he would send out a list of questions ahead of time for them to consider and then use those questions as his agenda. And if the secretaries, or excuse me, if the officers disagreed, then he would ask them to write out written opinions so that he make sure he understood every single perspective and point of view, and he had all of the evidence in front of him before making a decision. And so when Washington was in the presidency and decided he needed some sort of advisory body that was similar, that would provide the same sort of advice and support in moments of crisis, he used those same strategies to manage the sort of equally boisterous personalities of his secretaries.
And one of the things I really liked about your book, when you talk about these big personalities and somewhat big egos and loud opinions and everything that some of these cabinet secretaries, what we would typically now know, call them as cabinet secretaries, wanted to say and be heard and be listened to by Washington. We'll touch on some of them specifically here in just a little bit. But one of the things I really liked about your book is how you talked about in various ways that Washington felt like as he was putting together this cabinet, this advisory group, that they have strong social connections and relationships in addition to just sort of the day-to-day work that they typically engaged in terms of talking about the governance of the country. Why did Washington feel like developing those social connections was so important?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's, I think, one of the aspects of Washington's emotional intelligence that's not often appreciated. So in moments of war or moments of domestic crisis or whatever it is, if you have a conflict, it really helps to have pre-existing bonds and trust that are in place to help, smooth over any hurt feelings that maybe would happen if someone, speaks particularly harshly, or if you disagree, or if you get into an argument. Having that sort of bond allows for forgiveness. It allows for a sense of camaraderie and working towards a common cause. And so Washington understood that this was essential in the military to have this esprit de corps, because you're going to be literally fighting arm in arm with these people against your foe. But he felt that it was equally as important in the presidency, because these secretaries in his administration, they're trying to carve out a path for the nation. And it's easy for us when we, sort of think of from a 21st century perspective that, of course, the country was going to work. And of course, it was going to be fine, because it did and it has and we've survived. But that was very much not the case in the 1790s. And pretty much everyone involved feared constantly that the country was going to fail and it was going to crumble and it was going to be a disaster if they did something wrong or made the wrong decision. So having that sort of close-knit community was really important to endure that sort of stress and anxiety and get through those moments of great tension.
Lindsay Chervinsky is our guest here on Now Appalachia. We've been talking to her and are talking to her about her new book, The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. And Lindsay, we'll come back and talk to you more about that book in just a second because there's so many more fascinating things to touch on. But let's talk about your job outside of being a writer and a historian, and that is being involved with the White House Historical Association, and you currently serve as the White House historian. So for our audience who may not be familiar with either one of those titles or institutions, first of all, what is the White House Historical Association, and what are your job duties and responsibilities as the White House historian?
Great question. So the White House Historical Association is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that is set up to help preserve the state floor of the White House, which is the first floor with the East Room, the Red Room, the Blue Room, the really famous historic rooms, and make sure that the historic items in it are preserved and taken care of, and to help collect art and items that represent the full breadth and depth of the American experience. The other half of our mission is an education and historical mission, which is where I come in, and my colleagues as well. And that is to share the history of the people that have lived in the White House, worked in the White House, built the White House. And that's everyone from the enslaved people that, you know, put down the first stones to the first families, as well as the big events and sort of the symbolic and complicated role of the White House in the American experience. So that's what the organization does. And my role changes every day. Sometimes I'm doing media, sometimes I'm doing tours, sometimes I'm teaching groups from elementary school to sort of, you know, senior groups that are coming through. Although since we're in the middle of a pandemic, that's not happening as much right now, but teaching and outreach is a huge part of my job. And then I do a lot of writing and research and everything from sort of answering a question that might come up from press or media or just a random, you know, person who sends in a question to writing my own books and everything in between.
So how did you get interested in history?
Oof. I'm not sure I've ever not been interested. I've always had a passion for historical fiction. I used to be I still am, but I just have a little bit less time. An absolutely voracious reader of historical fiction, and have been really fascinated by trying to figure out what it would have been like to live in different moments and what that lived experience would have been like, and how in some ways certain emotions are sort of timeless and just human qualities, but then other things seem so foreign and distant to me, like, you know, living without electricity or not having plumbing or, you know, needing to wear a corset, any of these sort of details that feel very far away from my current existence. And so I've always been fascinated by trying to figure out what life would have been like at different times, and was actually planning to be a lawyer all the way up through senior year in college, had applied to law schools, had gotten in, and kind of did a 180 at the last minute and realized that this was what I really loved, this was what I was good at, and since that was the case, why not actually make a life out of it?
Excellent. Very good. And back to your book for just a second. As you were researching this book and deciding to put it together, where did you go for the research? What did you use as sort of your primary source documents to help you put this book together? Where did you go? Where did you travel? What sources were helpful to you in terms of looking back at this period in American history to put together the items that you included in your book?
Well, I was really lucky in that the subjects of my book have obviously been subjects of great historical interest to a lot of people. So there's a ton of extraordinary literature on Hamilton and Jefferson and Washington and their relationships. And as a result, because they've been such prominent historical people, their papers and their records are generally very well preserved. And there are incredible paper editing projects that are funded and published through places like the University of Virginia Press and Princeton University Press and Harvard University Press, and they have a full team of incredible editors that compile all these documents, transcribe them, and then publish them in these volumes, and they are just treasure troves of incredible tidbits and resources that would make, without those volumes, it would have made my life much harder, and the project would have taken like three times as long. The amazing thing is that a lot of those volumes are also now online. There's a great project called Founders Online. It's run by the National Archives, and it means that all of these letters, or at least most of them, are searchable. And so that is just such a gift to historians, especially now when the archives are closed. So that was primarily where my sources came from, the papers of Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Washington, and Hamilton are all online. And then some of the sort of lesser or, you know, secondary characters like Knox and Randolph, although I would argue they're not secondary, but their papers are less sort of frequent, had to go to places like the Massachusetts Historical Society to get some of those papers. The Virginia Historical Society has some of Randolph's, although they've been kind of dispersed everywhere. Thomas Mifflin, who was the governor of Pennsylvania, his papers are in the Pennsylvania Historical Society. So thankfully, there are these incredible historical societies who take care of this archival material and provide those amazing resources to historians like me to be able to use them and then craft the story from those sources.
That's great. Fantastic. And thanks for sharing with us the Founders website as well. That's really great. The Founders papers. That's excellent.
Yeah. Anyone can look at it. It's free. It's incredible.
That's great. And we appreciate the National Archives for doing that. And gosh, the work that they do, we could spend a whole 2 hours just talking about the
National Archives
and what a real gem they are for our country in terms of preserving our history. But I want to ask you too, you kind of touched on this a second ago. How long did it take you to complete this project?
Well, so I started my PhD in 2011. I started doing the reading for this, sort of the secondary reading for this book, in probably early 2012. And so then it was published in spring of 2020. So I'm hoping that there's some interesting circumstances that go into a dissertation. You have to figure out how to write one, which is a a learned skill. And then once I wrote the dissertation, I rewrote it 3 times to get it to be where I wanted it for the book. So I don't actually recommend that as a strategy. If you can help it, don't rewrite your book 3 times. But I was so adamant that this was a story worth telling, and I wanted it to be accessible for a reader who didn't have a PhD, that I was determined to have the narrative arc and the figures and the characters and the story come through in a way that was compelling. And it just took me a long time to get that language to the place where I wanted it to be. So it took me 8 years. I'm very hopeful and optimistic that the next one will not take that long.
Excellent. Lindsay Chervinsky is our guest here today on Now Appalachia. We're talking to her about her career as a historian with the White House Historical Association, and also talking to her about her new book, The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. So Lindsay, let's go back to your book for just a little bit. I wanted to ask you something about some of the people that we meet, some of the people that Washington includes in this beginnings of a cabinet that he's putting together. We get introduced to Henry Knox. We get introduced to Thomas Jefferson. Again, most people know who some of these people are, their names. Alexander Hamilton, you mentioned Edmund Randolph a moment ago. Even John Adams figures into your book in terms of being an advisor to President Washington. So let me ask you, of all those people that he kind of includes in this makeshift cabinet, who was he closest to and who gave him the most trouble?
I love that question. So who he was closest to kind of changed over time. Initially, I would say when Washington first entered office, he was actually closest to James Madison. They had worked really closely during the Constitutional Convention, and Madison had long been a good friend, but their relationship began to fracture when Madison disagreed with the administration about Hamilton's financial legislation. So then I would say that Hamilton was probably the closest advisor for a while. Although, you know, it's hard to tell because Washington very rarely wrote down his emotions. So I think that he remained up until the end of 1794 incredibly close to Henry Knox. And so perhaps on a personal level, they were the closest. But Hamilton, I think, probably was his most frequent advisor. And then when Hamilton retired at the end of January 1795, then Edmund Randolph, who had been the Attorney General and then became the second Secretary of State, he was a really, really important advisor. And he too had been friends with Washington for decades. He had served as Washington's aide-de-camp early in the war and then as his private attorney. and probably was as close to Washington as anyone or as a man actually got in terms of friendship. And we know that they were so close and he was such an important advisor because in 1795, when the Jay Treaty arrived from Great Britain, Washington shared it with Randolph and they kept it a secret from the other secretaries and from the Senate. And that would have never happened when Hamilton and Jefferson were in office. So they had a very special relationship for a while as well. In terms of trouble, that's a tricky one. I mean, I think Hamilton and Jefferson are probably the sort of obvious choices. They were so combative and they hated each other so much by the end of Jefferson's tenure as Secretary of State. They were constantly complaining about each other, constantly ragging on each other, constantly writing or getting other people to write anonymous things in the newspapers about each other. I think Jefferson probably Hamilton's legislation certainly caused some issues because he was constantly pushing new ideas, which sometimes posed a challenge. But on a personal level, I think Jefferson was probably more problematic because he encouraged the founding of a newspaper that's sole job was basically to criticize the administration. So while Washington was never totally sure about that, he had a pretty good inkling and that really annoyed him. So I think probably Jefferson with, you know, an assist from Hamilton.
Very good. What kind of relationship did George Washington have with John Adams?
Complicated. Initially, when they first entered office, they always had a great deal of respect for one another. They respected their commitment. They respected their commitment to public service and duty and honor. Initially, when Washington first entered office, he was very solicitous of Adams' opinions about how he should comport himself in public, how he should interact with other citizens, how he should host people and, you know, celebrate and dine, and what sort of activities could the president actually participate in. But I think that relationship soured a little bit because John Adams got into some political trouble. Because he advised the Senate that the president should have a much loftier title than Mr. President. It should be something, I don't remember the exact title, but I think it was like His Highness and Protector of Their Liberties and Rights or something like that. It's a very long, slightly ridiculous title. And that really squandered a lot of his political capital. And so as a result, I just don't think Washington really trusted his judgment as much. He didn't ever write that down, but that's sort of my speculation because he never invited him to cabinet meetings. He never really invited him to be a part of the official family in the same way.
Interesting. Very interesting. There's an event that you write about in your book that occurred in 1794. And I think this kind of shows and kind of dovetails back with what you've been saying and what we've been talking about the cabinet and Washington's view of them and how much he really came to rely on their advice and perspective. In 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion occurs, and that's something that Washington has to deal with. And he really leans on his cabinet during that period to provide him with a great deal of help and advice. So what was the Whiskey Rebellion, and how was the cabinet helpful to Washington during that time?
So in 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion officially broke out. In 1791, Congress had passed a series of excise taxes on home distilleries. And home distilleries were quite popular in Western regions like Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, where it was really hard to get your excess grain and corn to eastern ports because at that time the United States did not have access to the Mississippi River. It was under Spanish control. And so the only way that you could get your goods to a port to sell it was to put it on a wagon and pay someone to drive it over the mountains. Not only was that not possible several months of the year because they weren't passable because of weather, it was also very expensive and it completely obliterated your profits. And so what a lot of people would do is they would distill that excess grain into whiskey or alcohol and they would trade it. They would use it as a form of currency. They would barter it. And so that was really a part of daily life. And so these Western regions felt that this tax was incredibly unfair. And it really was burdensome for these communities. And so there was all forms of sort of peaceful protests that were sort of ignored. And that became much more violent in the summer of 1794 when rebels in western Pennsylvania, sort of near Pittsburgh, burned down the house of the local tax collector. And that was one step too far for the administration. They were willing to sort of overlook other forms of resistance and sort of threats of violence in places like Kentucky and North Carolina, but not actual violence in Pennsylvania, which was the state where the Capitol was located at that time. So Washington gathered his cabinet and discussed what they should do. Henry Knox and Alexander Hamilton wanted to immediately send in the militia and kind of go from 0 to 10 right away. Edmund Randolph wanted to engage in sort of peaceful negotiations to see if they could come to some sort of agreement or compromise. And William Bradford, who was the Attorney General, suggested sort of a midline approach, which was to send out a peace commission to try and come up with a peaceful solution, but in the meantime, get the militia ready so that if it failed, they would be ready to act with something a little bit more powerful. And that really appealed to Washington's sensibilities because he liked decisive action, but he also really liked having public opinion behind him and having their support. And so this allowed him to demonstrate that he had tried all peaceful solutions and could sort of curry public opinion on behalf of military action before he actually sent out troops. So then the cabinet takes on a very important role because Washington needs to get Pennsylvania officials to cooperate with this action. And Pennsylvania officials really felt like this should be a state matter, not a federal matter. And so the cabinet basically is in cahoots and browbeats the Pennsylvania officials into submission through a series of really extraordinary letters that Hamilton writes and then Edmund Randolph, as the Secretary of State, sends to the Pennsylvania officials and basically forces them to comply. So the cabinet is central to the federal government's response, but not because they're trying to gain more power for themselves, but because they're trying to enforce presidential authority, which is a very important distinction and a very interesting series of events that they are trying to sort of carve out this sphere of presidential influence over domestic policy.
Very good. Very good. And I had forgotten about the Whiskey Rebellion. I can remember reading it, you know, in high school and in college, and you did such a great job of setting out what it was and why it happened and why it was important. And then the cabinet's role, that was one of my favorite sections of the book. And I think it really just shows the strength of the book, which is the way that you combine the history with the narrative and sort of telling us the story of kind of what happened and why it happened and who was involved and what was the outcome. So Lindsay, I have a question that's not really tied to your book, but I know that you've studied George Washington a lot and you are an expert on him and his life and his presidency. He didn't have a real active life post-presidency, but we learn later that after his death, that Martha Washington discarded a lot of his letters, a lot of his notes, a lot of journal entries and diary entries that he kept. As a historian who has really studied Washington, what do you think we lost, both from your perspective as a historian, but from our perspective as citizens when we look back on this period? What do you think we lost, or what do you think was in those journals and diaries that she destroyed that really would have helped us understand more about this period in history and the founding of our nation?
Oh, well, it's so heartbreaking. I wish that that was not the case and that she had not done so. My guess is that he had worked very hard for a very long time to cultivate a certain persona and a certain image in the public mind of who he was and his service and his commitment to the nation. And so I think that they probably agreed that they would destroy anything that didn't fully support that vision, whether it be a very passionate love letter to her or, you know, a criticism about someone that they wanted to maintain a good relationship with. And so it definitely, you know, destroys our ability to have a full and complete sense of events and what happened. It's one of the reasons that history and the telling of history is sort of ever evolving, because we do continue to find new evidence and new information and are able to sort of consider things in a new light. I think the biggest tragedy is that it has caused us as a nation to see him as this sort of semi-godlike or non-human entity, and that he was sort of perfect and never did the wrong thing and never made a mistake. Now, obviously, that's not true. He had a cruel side. He could be cold. He owned enslaved people even after he felt that morally it was wrong, and certainly took steps to free the people that he owned, but knew he could have done more and chose not to. So, I mean, he obviously was a very flawed person. But I think if we had gotten a full sense of his personality, we would better be able to say, here is this person who is very real and very, you know, human, but did these extraordinary things. And what does that tell us about leadership and what maybe at times when the country needs extraordinary moments of leadership, what can we look for? What qualities can we look for that maybe are replicated? And now we kind of just see him as this marble bust that's never going to come back again, and no one that extraordinary is ever going to exist. And I think that that is both a far less interesting story and a far less useful one for our country.
Very well said. So in our final moments with you today, Lindsay, what are you working on next? You alluded to books, and that part of your job is to get an opportunity to research and write books. And I think you teased us that maybe there's another one that you're working on, or maybe another one in the pipeline. So what are you working on next?
Yeah, so I cannot quite yet get away from cabinets. I think that they are such an extraordinary way to look at a presidency and to evaluate someone's leadership, because regardless of who it is, they're dealing with people that have extraordinary power and ego and ambitions at the highest levels of government. And it's an almost impossible task to manage those types of people. And so I'm going to do a comparison of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson's cabinets, because Adams had one of the worst. It was borderline treasonous. And Jefferson had one of the best. It had the least turnover in American history and was an incredibly effective tool for public and congressional outreach. So I think that should be a really interesting story to tell. I've done some of the research. I'm continuing work on that now. And I'm excited to see what it tells us about the presidency that we don't already know.
Excellent. Very good. Sounds like a great project. We'd love to have you back on to talk about it. That's
absolutely
great. So Lindsay, where can folks get copies of your book if they're interested in getting copies of The Cabinet? Where can they get copies of your book? And how can they stay in contact with you if they want to reach out to you to talk to you about the book, about the White House Historical Association, about anything going on there? How can they get in contact with you? And where can they get copies of your book?
Absolutely. So in terms of social media, I'm most active on Twitter. My handle is LM Chervinsky. And if you want to get in contact with me or read more of my writing or see any of my work, you can go to my website, which is lindsaychervinsky.com. You can get, if you are interested in a sort of personalized autographed copy of the book, you can purchase them actually on my website. Or you can buy them at any of your favorite book selling locations, whether it be Amazon or Harvard University Press or your local bookstore. They can also get the book for you. So if you want to support a local business, you can do that as well. I'm very grateful to anyone who wants to buy it, wants to read it, and more than happy to answer your questions and engage once you've done so. I love to hear from readers.
Fantastic. Lindsay Chervinsky has been our guest here today on Now Appalachia. We've been talking to her about her new book. It's called The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution. And Lindsay is doing great work, not only with that book, but her work with the White House Historical Association, where she currently serves as the White House historian. And if you're thinking, I don't know if I want to get this book because it might be like those high school history textbooks that I didn't really like too well, I can assure you, having read the book, that that is not the case. She does a great job of not only telling this story almost like it were fiction, but she gives you a formal introduction and a summative conclusion at the end of each section of the book. So this is not the high school history textbook that you never read and didn't like. This is an excellent glimpse into our nation's founding and what these, as Lindsay's alluded to, what these otherwise ordinary men did in extraordinary times and how they used their talents and their gifts to help our country come together. It's a fantastic look back into a tremendous period and an important period in our nation's history. And Lindsay, congratulations on the book. It's a wonderful story, and I cannot wait, personally, as someone who's an Adams fan, I can't wait to read your new book about the cabinets of Adams and Jefferson. It sounds like it's going to be fantastic, and we'd love to have you on to talk about it. But in the meantime, congratulations on the book, and thanks for all the good work you're doing with the White House Historical Association. And thanks for coming on Now Appalachia.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for those kind words. I hope that people, if I can ask people to take away one thing, it's that history does not have to be boring. So find what excites you and enjoy reading that. And if it's my book, then that's wonderful. And thank you. Thank you all again.
Very well said. Thank you, Lindsay, so very much. That's going to do it for this episode of Now Appalachia. We did want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Our podcasts are made possible by the good work and the efforts of our executive producer of Now Appalachia and also the executive producer of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Her name is Pam Stack. We appreciate all the work Pam does behind the scenes to make these podcasts possible, each and every episode here on Now Appalachia and all of our podcasts that are available on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We couldn't do it without Pam's help, and we appreciate so much her support. And that will do it for us this time on Now Appalachia. Until next time, I'm your host, Elliot Parker. And as always, please stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next. Stay tuned for more outstanding podcasts from the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.